From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Starting next year, power bills in Southern Nevada will look a little different. That's due to a rate charging scheme by NV Energy. Traditionally, power bills are calculated based on the amount of electricity you use. The investor-owned company instead wants to institute what they're calling a new demand charge. It's based on a 15-minute snapshot of a customer's peak daily usage. NV Energy is also revamping its net metering program for new rooftop solar customers in northern Nevada. The company will now calculate credits for electricity returned to the grid every 15 minutes rather than monthly, as it does now. The changes are controversial, drawing criticism from customers and consumer protection advocates. Despite that, the Public Utilities Commission of Nevada approved both changes earlier this year. The commission is currently reconsidering those changes. But why is NV Energy pursuing this change? And more importantly, what does it mean for customers? I sat down with Megan Delaney, a spokesperson for NV Energy, to learn more.
Megan, this change that you are seeking, as I understand it, would recalculate bills based on peak demand. So NV Energy will capture a 15-minute window of a customer's energy usage during peak demand hours and use that as the rate for the rest of the day. Explain to me how it works.
The way this demand charge will work is we'll look at an individual customer's peak demand use in their own home. So that could be 2 in the afternoon for someone based on your schedule. If that's when you're running your AC, when you're running your washer, when you're using all of your appliances, that could be when you spike your demand during the day. Could be at 7 o'clock at night if you're cooking, if you're cleaning, doing all that. So this will look at your individual 15 minutes of max consumption of energy in a day. And we will multiply that against the approved rate, and that will be your daily demand charge for the day. So we've looked, the average NV Energy customer's peak rate is 3.5 kilowatts in that time period. So what you would do is you would multiply 3.5 times 14 cents, which is the demand rate that the commission approved, and that's about 50 cents. So that's your charge for the day. It resets the next day, and at the end of the month, you would add all those charges up together. And that's what the demand charge will be on your bill. But it's important that when we design this, we have lowered other portions of the bill so that overall your bill stays the same or goes down slightly as the average NV Energy customer.
That's a significant departure from the way electric bills have been calculated in the past. Why does NV Energy need to do this?
We need to build the infrastructure that serves customers to meet that maximum demand whenever you use it. If we're not building the system to meet your individual maximum demand, you're not going to have power when and where you need it. So this helps us look at when the demand is and make sure that we're building appropriately. It helps create a stronger, more resilient grid in the future. Second, this gives customers another tool as to how they can manage their bill. For years, we have told customers, if you want a lower bill, reduce how much energy you use a month. Now, you can still do that. But you also can control your demand charge and change your habits if you want to lower your bill. But really, one of the biggest things that this does is this helps get at an inequity that's been created by the current rooftop solar system.
What do you mean by inequity?
So rooftop solar customers are customers who have chosen to put privately owned solar panels on their rooftops, and they connect those solar panels to the grid, to NV Energy's grid. And for the most part, they generate a lot of their energy that they use. Obviously, when the sun's not shining, cloudy days, they're not generating energy, so they still need to be connected to NV Energy to get power when they're not generating it. And they do send their excess energy back to us, and we compensate them for that extra energy that they set us. But what has happened in that policy is because so many of those customers are generating credits, they are not contributing what it actually takes to serve them. So those costs are not being paid for by those rooftop solar customers, and the way the system is set up is they're being paid for by the non-rooftop solar customers. So adding this demand charge is another way to ensure that rooftop solar customers pay for the energy they use and pay for what it takes NV Energy to serve them.
Of course, these changes only affect Southern Nevada. In Northern Nevada, something a little different. The PUC has approved changes how the company calculates net metering rates for new solar customers. Talk to me about that.
So the way we do billing for most net metering or rooftop solar customers, as we call them kind of interchangeably, We would look at the end of the month how much energy you sent to us and how much energy you needed from us. And there's a billing mechanism, a credit system that does that at the end of the month. And then customers get excess energy credits based on how much extra they sent, if they sent us extra energy. So now with the technology we have and the ability to look at this on a more real-time system, we're moving it to a 15 minute. So every 15 minutes we'll do that netting, that crediting. And that's how those customers will be measured going forward. It's a more true, accurate, in-the-moment look at what they're using and what they're sending to us.
You know, your critics have long argued that NV Energy has hampered rooftop solar development in favor of large-scale industrial projects. Wouldn't you agree that this change further disincentivizes customers from investing in rooftop solar?
No, I think is the answer. We support an all of the approach when it comes to providing energy for Nevadans. We have solar resources, we have geothermal, we have wind, we have natural gas. We're looking at every approach that we can. By the end of 2025, we'll actually be out of coal, so that's no longer a resource that we'll have in NV Energy portfolio. And for some customers, if they do the math and it still makes sense for them to put rooftop solar on their home or residence, we will continue to support that. And so looking at this, we were really looking at how do we fix that inequity for the majority of NV Energy customers who do not have rooftop solar. So a lot of customers who don't own their roof can't put panels on it. They don't have the right kind of roof. It doesn't face the right direction. It doesn't get the right kind of sun. And so we supplement that by building large-scale utility solar or contracting for that large-scale utility solar energy. And so we really see it as everything plays a role. There is room for everyone. And we need to make sure that when Nevadans flip the light switch in their home, that the power is there for them.
The Bureau of Consumer Protection in the Nevada Attorney General's office says these changes are illegal. You know, they point to state law that says the utility and the PUC is strictly prohibited from charging a rate based on time of usage. They want the commission to reverse the decision. What's the company's response?
So obviously NV Energy believes that what we put forward is consistent with state law, and the commission has approved that, and there is the process for BCP to ask for them to reconsider that, and we will participate in that process with the commission. I believe the commission is going to hear those petitions for reconsideration at a meeting in late November, and you know, we respect that process that the commission is going to go through, and we'll continue to participate in that through this case. At this time, we are moving forward with our plans to implement the demand charge in April.
That was NV Energy spokesperson Megan Delaney. Despite the company's insistence that the changes will mean little for the average NV Energy customer, there are some who question the company's motives. They include Julia Hubbard with Solar United Neighbors, a national nonprofit group that advocates for rooftop solar. I asked Hubbard what she makes of the changes.
The daily demand charge is not an effective way to manage peak demand. And we've seen that from several people state this, right? The reason why we have demand charges is for large users. It's not for small users like residential customers. So we do not think the daily demand charge should be implemented. We think it's harmful, and we hope that they will reconsider that. We also don't think that the 15-minute netting is legal as well, and really devalues solars and makes it more difficult for people to go solar. When we need all the energy sources we can right now, we should be really incentivizing solar.
Part of NV Energy's reasoning for these changes is that rooftop solar customers have created an inequity within the electrical grid. They say it's costing them money to provide services to those customers, especially when those panels are not producing power. What do you make of that argument?
I think the way that we would come about this is that these changes, so a daily demand charge for Southern Nevada customers, as well as changing from monthly netting to 15-minute netting for new solar owners in the north, are all really harmful for people who are just struggling to pay their bills and be able to have energy affordability in this time. And specifically with the comment that these are as a result of solar owners, we would say that's just not true. The studies that NV Energy is citing are not looking at the system-wide cost savings that solar provides to the grid, right? These are homeowners who are adding infrastructure to the grid and sending energy to the grid. And those are costs that NV Energy doesn't have to pay for, right? They're not having to maintain those systems. They're also not having to install more transmission lines or gas peaker power plants to serve those customers and to serve other neighbors who live right next door to those homeowners with solar.
The PUC is in the process of reconsidering the rate changes. That should happen later in the month. That said, unless anything changes, these rates will go into effect in April. So what do you recommend people do to keep their energy costs at a minimum?
So if the daily demand charge goes into effect, we're really encouraging people to spread their usage throughout the day and avoid stacking their usage at any one given time. Because with the daily demand charge, they're going to be capturing your greatest usage during the day over a 15-minute period. So it's going to be important to be mindful of your consumption, which is difficult, right? Most people are not tracking their energy usage every 15 minutes, and it's really easy to forget and have a number of appliances on all at once. Or there's folks who just cannot change their patterns because they get home from work, they've got to do all of this stuff all at once. So this could really harm working families.
Julia Hubbard is the Nevada Program Director for Solar United Neighbors, a national nonprofit group that advocates for rooftop solar. Julia, thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul. I really appreciate the opportunity to connect.
You can, of course, learn more about these rate changes at our website, knpr.org. As a note of disclosure, NV Energy is a corporate supporter of Nevada Public Radio.
We'll get to celebrate afterwards. Another championship for UNLV. We will have, hopefully, Coach LaRocca's Collins turnaround jumper from the left mid-block is good. Erica Collins.
That was the sound of the UNLV Lady Rebels winning their fourth straight regular season Mountain West title in March. The women's basketball team is ranked first in the conference again this season. Many credit their success to head coach Lindy LaRocca. She's heading into her sixth year with the team, whose regular season begins this evening when they face off against Washington State. Ahead of that game, LaRocca talked with KNPR's Heidi Kaiser about the expectation of winning, the Lady Rebels' 9 new players, and more.
Lindy LaRocca, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thanks for having me.
It's a delight to have you here. You have so many, I guess, wins to your name, sort of literally and figuratively. Looking back on your career with the Lady Rebels, what are some of the big highlights for you personally?
Well, honestly, this is my first head coaching job. And so that is probably the first win. Being born and raised here in Las Vegas to coach my hometown team, honestly, it still feels surreal. And, you know, I've known what the program can be and what it's been. And I was really excited to bring it back there. And so I think just being the head coach, honestly, is the first win for me. But then kind of once we got into the thick of it, being able to go back to that NCAA tournament after 20 years of not going and kind of breaking that slump or bad streak, if you will, I think that was really momentous and memorable for me, you know, that I'll cherish for a long time.
Yeah, and you kind of alluded to this already, but you are heading into your sixth year at the helm of the Lady Rebels. And you mentioned breaking that 20-year dry spell. I know that there's a lot involved, but just top line for folks who may not have been watching, what were the big changes that you made?
I think it starts with people, and I just really credit my staff, the people that I have around me. Everyone wants to know is the key to success in anything, in any field. And I do think across industries, it's about having the right people at the right place at the right time, working really hard, doing the right thing.
And in 2024-25, you won your fourth straight Mountain West regular season championship title. Does that create some pressure now to do it every year going forward?
Honestly, yeah, it does. But you know, it's also the expectation of the program and where we've put ourselves. And so, you know, maybe it's pressure, but it's not overwhelming because that's also what we expect and the standard that we've set. Now, I think outside looking in, it's really hard to do. So then whenever the time comes and it doesn't happen, it doesn't necessarily make us a failure. But in the meantime, we're going to try to keep winning.
And your players, of course, you're a big part of that, but the players are as well. You've got Meadow Rowland, who is the 2024 Mountain West freshman and sixth player of the year. Aaliyah Alexander, who was named to the 2025-26 preseason All-Mountain West team, and several others. How have you been able to put those pieces into place and get those lines together, those lineups that really work for you?
I think pieces are the right analogy because every year it's a different puzzle. You know, even players that are returning are different. They have different roles. Then we've brought in some new freshmen and some new transfers, and those are different pieces that we've never had. So I have to be a puzzle wizard of sorts. And so, but, you know, I'm excited about the talent that we have, and we're still very early in our process. But I think for me, that is the challenge, to figure out the right combinations, who plays best together and the times that we need, and who can really thrive off of each other. You know, that's my job, is kind of the game manager.
And other than Alexander and Roland, tell us about some of the special players we should be watching this year.
Yeah, you know, I expect our starting point guard to be Tegan Colvin. She's a returner. She was a freshman last year. Didn't get a ton of minutes, to be honest, because she played against and behind an all-conference player, but really excited about the work that she's done in the offseason to step up. You know, and then we have an incredible group of transfers. Destiny Leo is a three-point shooter from Cleveland State. Destiny Brown, you know, is a great story. She started here at CSN, then went to Alcorn State for 3 years, and then has now come back to UNLV for her grad year. Excited about her size and length as a forward. Shelby Brown, a transfer from Akron, just a really high-energy player that I love coaching. You know me, I'm the coach. I could say something positive about all of them, but I am really excited about this group and kind of how we're coming together.
And we have the WNBA team, the Las Vegas Aces, here in Las Vegas, mm-hmm. Obviously. Great team, just won this year's championship title for the third time.
Mm-hmm.
How has the presence of the Aces here in Las Vegas influenced the Lady Rebels, if at all?
First of all, I agree. Obviously, it's great to have them in town, and we have a great relationship with them. I think maybe the number one thing is just a fan base. Together, we've cultivated a women's basketball fan base here in town to where you can watch women's basketball year-round. You know, they have thousands of people at their game. We're still working to get the attendance numbers that they have, but we know it's here in town, and so that's exciting. The other piece is just for our young players and our young women and the development of girls in sports, to not just have the college to look up to, but to have the professional ranks here in town. So truly, if you can see it, you can be it mantra. You know, again, not just in college, but if, you know, even for our own players, our players want to play professionally.
You mentioned attendance. Of course, it's been in the news for the last couple of years, the impact that players like Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese have had on women's sports generally, but the WNBA in particular, and women's basketball at the NCAA level. Have you seen that at UNLV as well?
I think our attendance, but I think it's also where it's reflected, is we have a summer camp for girls only. And every year we've had more and more girls attend. And honestly, I haven't changed any marketing. So it's not, you know, the grassroots marketing that I'm doing. I think it's just the exposure of women's basketball. We're trying to continue to infuse the student body to come out and really support us as well. But I think all of that momentum created by some of those star headline players, I think that's felt across the country, even if that player isn't on our team. Absolutely.
And I guess the flip side of that is some of the drama that's going on right now in the WNBA between the players and the coaches with the negotiations mm-hmm. over the collective bargaining agreement and some complaints about leadership and that sort of thing. Does that trickle down as well to the college level? I mean, you all must be paying attention.
Sure. You know, obviously everyone, I think, watches ESPN or hears at least the headlines of it all. I think, you know, maybe what it points to most is that the landscape is changing, not just at the professional level, but it has at our collegiate level, even with revenue sharing. And if anything, it's the landscape of women's sports. And we have to fight and claw for seemingly proportional equitable pay, equitable opportunity and resources. And it's nice to actually have some powerful voices, like some of those WNBA players really speaking up on that. And hopefully that then kind of comes down because, I mean, we know as women, we've had to fight for everything we've had and those before us. And we'd love for sports to lead, not lag in that progress. And I think that's really what we're all fighting for at our own levels, even collegiately with the landscape that's changed for us.
Lindy LaRocque is the UNLV Lady Rebels head coach, 3-time Mountain West Coach of the Year, and she is just about to start the 2025-26 season. Lindy, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Sports is big business in Nevada. Take the Canelo Alvarez and Terrence Crawford fight at Allegiant Stadium in September. That match raked in a reported $47 million in ticket sales alone. Of course, boxing has a long history in the state. It was the first in the U.S. to legalize professional prize fighting around the turn of the 20th century. Since then, Nevada has hosted some of the sport's biggest bouts. But now that Las Vegas is home to several professional sports teams, some fans worry the state will lose its place at the heart of professional boxing. KNPR's Ann Davis looked into it for her story in the current issue of our city regional magazine, Desert Companion. She brings us this report.
A boxer is pouring sweat as he throws 1-2 combos at his trainer. It's a common sight at Fight Capital Gym. Today, half a dozen college-age men and women are gearing up, stretching, and waiting for their turn to hop in the ring. They're with UNLV's boxing club, and they're warming up for their first training session of the fall 2025 semester.
So, I mean, it originally started as a hobby. It was something to get me in shape. I've lost probably 70 pounds doing this already.
That's Wyatt English. He's one of the members of the club. Even though he won the Super Heavyweight National Championship at this year's U.S. Intercollegiate Boxing Association tournament, he's still considered an amateur. At one point in Nevada's history, amateur boxing was popular. Nowadays, not so much. With the athletic infusion Las Vegas has experienced in the last decade, it's made experts wonder, what's next for boxing in the fight capital of the world?
There's a higher return in other sports right now, and that's largely because of the television exposure that, you know, pays the universities to be able to pay the athletes.
That's Bruce Trampler. He's an international boxing Hall of Fame promoter who moved to Nevada in the mid-1980s to work with Vegas-based Top Rank. He says that Vegas is still a major venue for pay-per-view and large title fights like the Canelo Alvarez v. Terrence Crawford bout in September. But he cautions that this might not always be the case, especially considering the neglect shown to amateur fights.
There's so many things you can do in Vegas now. For the amateurs specifically, you'd usually be relying on locals, and the locals have more to do.
Now, at least for the pros, Trampler says there's a lot of international rather than homegrown interest.
Most of the big name fighters are in Europe right now, England, the Middle East.
That's true for funding, too. Since 2019, boxing has seen an influx of Saudi Arabian money under the banner of Turkey Alashik's Riyadh season, which was a sponsor of Alvarez versus Crawford. Some trainers, like Mayweather Boxing and Fitness's Leonard Ellerby, see this cash infusion as a positive development for boxers choosing to fight in Vegas. That's especially since pay-per-view piracy is becoming a growing problem for all of combat sports. Here's Ellerby.
It's kind of hard to grow the sport, you know, from the fighter's perspective, because that's how they take care of their families. you know, the elite athletes. And that's when you have a Turkey Alacik who stepped in and he's been able to pay the fighters so they don't have to not make the big fights.
Trampler is more skeptical. Despite the cash infusion, he's of the opinion that many have lost interest. He says it's not like the old days.
When I moved to Vegas, we had boxing writers, you know, beat writers for each sport. And they would write two advanced stories the week of the fight, three stories. They'd cover the weigh-in, they'd cover the fight, they'd have a post-fight story.
Trampler doesn't see that anymore. Yet, experts are cautious to not discount boxing's future in Las Vegas. Rather, it's simply changing as promoters attempt to find the correct fit for a city with so many sports options. And while the city and the sport attempt to bolster the amateur ranks, Vegas's amateur fighters themselves, like Wyatt English, are seeing individual successes.
As long as I keep winning, I'll definitely keep competing with that.
Back at the UNLV Boxing Club practice, head coach Jason Crocco beams as he talks about his students.
You're part of a legacy. Like, you don't have to be the Mike Tyson or Floyd Mayweather. You can be like that first-time fighter. You're still part of history and part of a community.
Perhaps boxing really can remain a contender in the state that was instrumental in bringing the sport into the mainstream. Ann Davis, KMPR News.
Wildlife and vehicle collisions happen too often across our region. According to the Nevada Department of Transportation, more than 500 wildlife vehicle collisions happen across the state every year. It happens so often that Nevada is one of several Mountain West states investing millions of dollars to create safe animal crossings. From the Mountain West News Bureau, Stephanie Daniel reports on how those efforts are starting to make a difference along one stretch of highway in northern Colorado.
Highway 287 is a busy thoroughfare. In North Larimer County, it winds through rural communities and wildlife habitat.
You could say that Highway 287 was kind of a ribbon of death for wildlife because they all have to cross it on their traditional east-west seasonal movements.
Rick Knight is a professor at Colorado State University who lives in this area. Standing in the Stonewall Creek bed, which runs underneath the highway, he explains why 287 was dangerous in this spot.
There used to be a big old wicked five-strand barbed wire fence here.
Ranchers who own the land on either side of the highway would open this barbed wire fence only for their cattle to pass through. Otherwise, it was closed. So wildlife had to cross on the highway above. Stonewall Creek is part of a 30-mile stretch of the highway in North Larimer County that can be treacherous for animals and motorists. Over a four-year period ending in 2024, more than 300 vehicles crashed along this part of the highway. A third were caused by wildlife, primarily deer. None were fatal for humans, but lots of animals were killed. Knight and a few others came up with an idea to help wildlife cross safely.
This is a typical wildlife-friendly crossing. It's beneath the highway. It has a gate so the landowners can still move their cows on either side of their pastures.
Knight got permission from local ranchers to take down the barbed wire fence and put up this wildlife-friendly crossing. Situated under the highway, it's simple. Next to the gate are wooden posts that allow deer, pronghorn, elk, and other wild animals to pass through.
All they're doing is making motorists a lot safer because wildlife have an alternative.
Wildlife fencing and overpass projects are happening across Colorado, funded by state and federal dollars. These are big construction projects that can take many months to build. But crossings like this one in Stonewall Creek are much smaller. Each costs about $500 and takes a day to build.
We tried it out with a volunteer day with students.
That's Front Range Community College faculty member Heather Danahauer. She partnered with Knight on this project. They asked students from both of their schools to help out.
They loved it. We loved it. It seemed to be successful, and so it's just kind of grown from there.
Since 2021, CSU and FRCC students have built four wildlife-friendly crossings under 287. Danahauer says they've studied the impacts roads and fences can have on wildlife habitat.
Getting them out on the landscape to actually see the barriers, to actually be a part of a solution, I think that's far more impactful.
The team has partnered on this project with state agencies like the Colorado Department of Transportation. They hope to build more crossings, but for now, students can monitor the wildlife and collect data thanks to cameras installed at each location. Back at the Stonewall Creek Wildlife Crossing underneath Highway 287.
I have a little binder. I just kind of keep basic camera notes. I give all the cameras names.
Brick Knight's colleague Annie Hoffman is swapping out SD cards and batteries on two cameras.
I'm going to put these back over there and then do the next one.
Hoffman helped build this crossing in 2024 when she was a student at FRCC. Now she works at CDOT. Part of her job is to manage the images taken by the cameras. So far, she's cataloged close to 1 million photos of wildlife.
You can see how much use it's getting, and wildlife aren't getting hit because they're using a safer structure.
CDOT is using this data to help inform future strategies to prevent collisions between wildlife and drivers on Highway 287. Because, as the images show, animals are now finding another way to cross the road. In Larimer County, Stephanie Daniel, KUNC.
This is KNPR's State of Nevada. I'm Paul Boger. You're hearing the new release, Avoid, by local musician Brett Bolton. But your experience is incomplete because you're not seeing it. Bolton is an audiovisual artist and designer. He creates musical pieces and ties visual elements in real time with nothing but a drum kit and touchpad. Avoid is the latest iteration in Bolton's fascinating career devoted to the evolution of audiovisual entertainment. He sat down with KNPR's Mike Privat to discuss it.
Brett Bolton, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for being here. Let's go back a little bit. What came first for you as a creative person? Was it playing music or was it working with computer visuals?
It was always music. I grew up in Vegas playing drums in a lot of like local bands here. And eventually, once I started having like smaller bands, I was in a band called Cube Meets Cougar with Courtney Carroll. And we basically realized we're just a two-person band. We're doing electronic music. We kind of wanted to have a little extra something for our live performances. So that's when I learned how to kind of make visuals for our show. Got into After Effects and a bunch of software that was out at the time and eventually became really addicted to making visuals. And then that became a career, which became these experiments I do now.
So it was during Kids Meet Cougar that you had the sort of Reese's Peanut Butter Cup revelation that you could put these two things together and they would equally have an effect.
Yeah, totally. Like there's something really special about making a visual that is made for the audio. Like once you see everything synced up perfectly with an artist performing live, it was just really impactful for us.
Now, I watched the music video for your single Avoid. It's a dual view video where half of the screen shows the visuals you're generating in real time, and then the other half is you performing behind the drum kit and with the touchpad next to you. And after you move your finger on the pad and generate a visual on that pad, the synthesized music starts, and then you start playing drums, and then the visuals start morphing along with the song dynamics, and eventually, it's an instrumental electronic music number with many different audio layers. Now, how much of this is coming from the drums and how much of it is coming from the touchpad?
It's kind of 50-50. I like every like performance to be, everything's real time, as you mentioned, so there's no rendered video. So I can basically improv like throughout the course of the song. I can kind of, on the touchpad, I can loop a section and kind of have that generate a sound along with the visual. But then I can play along with that loop that I create on the drums. So I can kind of basically be like a one-man band, but I still have things like backing tracks behind me that kind of are adding some more dimension to it. But yeah, it gives me a lot of free rein to kind of just experiment and have fun.
Now, did you have to attain a certain level of mastery with the drums before you could then simultaneously work the hardware?
Drums have always been kind of just like a passion of mine. So I've been playing drums since I was like a teenager. That was just kind of like a fun thing I can add to these systems. It's more of me learning the systems and learning the software and building those out first. And then drums are just an added bonus I get to add on top to kind of add the human element.
About the visuals, before you start performing a number, do you imagine what the song, quote, looks like, and then go to the pad to create that initial image, which is then morphed as the song changes? Or do the pad and its programs give you a little more to work with when it comes to that initial visual representation?
The visuals are just as important as music to me. So I often come up with an idea for the visuals first, as opposed to the music. And then I kind of go back and forth. Oh, this like looks like it could sound like this, like on the touchpad. So I'll make a sound effect for that. And then I'll play with that a bit, realize I can make a rhythm out of that, and then start making a song. And then it kind of builds back and forth from visual to audio back, you know, to make a song to actually build out the full thing. So they're built in tandem usually.
November 7th, this Friday, is the local release show for your new EP, simply called EP1, and that is set to take place at Dustland in the Arts District. What can audiences expect during your performance?
They could see kind of how everything works. I like to just make it a pretty quick set. I'll have a big screen behind me. I've got my drum set and my touchpad, and I'll kind of just fly through the different experiments that I've made. The main five songs I've been focusing on for this EP will be kind of have the most developed visuals, but the rest are like, I've got like maybe 10 different songs that'll kind of flow through. A lot of them are works in progress. A lot of them are just fun AV experiments I've done, but it should be a pretty interesting show.
There is more to your audio-visual profile, Brett. You work with XR stages used in TV and film productions. These swap the green screens that we always see in those DVD extras for LED ones that play the imagery and backgrounds that we see in the finished products. How do you play a part in those productions?
A lot of the same systems I use to design my live visuals are the same, like it's the same software called Notch that I use that I used to develop these XR visuals. So you can build full 3D worlds with the software. So the XR stages, you're able to put a camera within this 3D world and kind of use the camera in a virtual set. Yeah, and it's kind of just like a more elaborate version of what I do for my personal shows.
Now, you have also done visual designing for local venues for one-off superstar performances and major concert tours over the last 11 years. I mean, we're talking Rolling Stones, Harry Styles, Lil Nas X, U2, Katy Perry, Bruno Mars, and so on. How did you go from working with nightclubs on the Strip to designing these huge stadium shows?
I fell into a really good group of designers and studios that have been nice enough to kind of realize I like doing personal work, but then also hire me to do client work. Yeah, I specialize in that software, real-time software called Notch. So that's kind of been my main focus for these client arena tours and Sphere things. And yeah, I've been really lucky to be able to kind of push that.
You have done extensive work at the Sphere, specifically with U2, Phish, and the Dead & Company residencies. Now, those visuals are obviously a massive part of the experience there. Is there a lot of pressure in being partly responsible for such a widely shared viral type of show?
Definitely. There's definitely a lot of pressure, especially on the tech side, because there's so much that goes involved in creating these shows. It's very stressful, but it's also incredibly rewarding once everything works together and you see this like 17,000 people in one massive space sharing the experience together. Yeah, with Dead & Company, we got to do a real-time section for the drums and space section that they do. Oh, so yeah. I controlled that live. It's a totally new type of experience for a lot of people, but it's really fun.
Brett Bolton is an audiovisual artist and designer. He'll perform on November 7th, that's this Friday, at Dustland to celebrate the release of his new album, EP1. Go to KNPR.org for more details. Brett, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The holidays are right around the corner, and in Southern Nevada, that means the National Finals Rodeo. But before NFR comes the Indian National Finals Rodeo. The event is held every year in October, over 5 days in Las Vegas. And this year, KNPR's Jimmy Romo was at the event, and he found an older generation passing the torch to the next one as up-and-coming Cowboys competed for their shot at a world title.
Behind the bucking chute at the Indian National Finals Rodeo in Las Vegas, or INFR, young riders suit up in their protective gear. There's a good chance a 2,000-pound bull could step on them after they hit the ground. Rodeo hands funnel the bull from their pens to the chute through a series of gates. Then they set them one by one to let the rider get on. When it's time, the gates open, and the animals buck repeatedly, trying to throw the rider off its back. A junior bull rider has to hold on to a bull with one hand for at least 6 seconds to score points. Cassius Thomas, who's 17, held on long enough to secure his win in the Junior Bull Riding INFR World Championship.
Well, I just love the feeling, love the adrenaline, and sure love the money.
Cassius's father, Daniel Thomas, 52, was also a bull rider in his youth. Both are enrolled members of the Navajo Nation.
Oh, the Navajo Nation, I believe this is the way of life, given the horses, the livestock, the sheep. So it all goes back to that.
Navajo athletes are heavily represented in the INFR. Nearly 37% of all qualified athletes at this year's rodeo are from the Navajo Nation. The rodeo is a big deal to the Sovereign Nation, which covers 27,000 square miles in the Four Corners area of the southwestern U.S.
There's a lot of guys that come out of the Navajo Nation that have gone to the PBRL, PRCA. We look up to them and we want to be like them.
Children are inspired by watching their older relatives participate in the sport. That was the case for Cassius. It was also the case for bronc rider Ethan Heisman-Yazzie. The 18-year-old finished at the top of his category to win the Rookie Saddle Bronc Riding INFR World Championship. Young cowboys like Cassius and Ethan are the next generation of athletes. Daniel Thomas was in the stands watching other junior bull riders get thrown before scoring any points. Then it was time to watch Cassius take his turn.
World champion Cassius Thomas!
The feeling of while the bull was bucking, I could kind of anticipate what it felt like. So I was moving like back and forth, and I was like moving around like I was dancing or something.
Watching Cassius reminds Daniel of his days as a bull rider. He had to quit the sport he loved to provide for his family. As his children grew up, he still made time to train his sons who wanted to do rodeo. Cassius was one that liked it the best. Alonzo Yazzie, Ethan's father, also used to compete in the sport his son does now. He was a two-time qualifier in the INFR back in the early 2000s. Like Daniel Thomas, he had to quit the sport to raise his kids.
My kids are growing up and they're doing their best. I'm teaching them what I know how, you know, every day.
Both Ethan and Cassius are at a pivotal point in their sport. If they want to keep competing in rodeo, they'll have to move up a class to a more difficult level. But the families have a goal in mind.
And one day, I want my son to be a world champion.
Ethan and Cassius will go home with belt buckles and cash prizes, making the trip to Vegas worth the gamble. Jimmy Romo, KNPR News.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Privat, who oversees the arts and culture beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
So what is Cosmic Chicano?
Cosmic Chicano is the latest exhibition by local artist Brian Martinez. He wanted to pay homage to his Latino heritage and how it has influenced his life. The works that he created are not just Mexican and Mexican-American touchstones. Here, he merges various cultural signifiers, Latino or otherwise. For instance, take spray paint cans. That's something that's not inherently Latino, but he took those and he painted both luchador masks, which are probably the most well-known iconography of lucha libre wrestling and just inherently a symbol of pride in Mexican culture, and also skulls, another dominant cultural token of Mexican culture, and put them over the spray paint cans. Then he arranged and lined these reimagined cans in a way that just immediately grabs your eye when you see them. As for the cosmic part, Martinez wanted to blend the mystical and ancestral roots of Mexican culture with the more current figures and representations of Mexican-American culture. Another eye-grabbing work puts a painted wood sculpture of what I take to be the artist in a luchador mask, and he placed it over an American flag. The masked figure is also adorned in stars, and as you can imagine, this is a very multidimensional work of identity. Now, Martinez told Vegas PBS that this show took a couple years of, quote, living life and just letting ideas flow and become sketches in that time, followed by another year of creating works from those ideas. And that serves as a very good reminder that these art shows and the works that they exhibit are not just whipped up in 6 months. And you can see Brian Martinez's work at NUWU Art Gallery and Community Center through November 22nd. That's Thursday through Saturday.
And now we head on over to UNLV, where I see you have two events highlighted for us.
One is the 40th anniversary Madrugal Festival, which takes place twice on the evening of November 7th at Artemis Ham Hall. A madrugal is a unique choral piece, and they date back centuries, and as such, this will feature several choirs, many of them high school choirs from Southern Nevada and the surrounding region, and they'll be joined by UNLV students and members of the Las Vegas Master Singers. This is one of the more unique musical events that UNLV produces, and a big bonus for you culturally curious folks out there is that it's a free and ticketless event, so very little hassle in attending. Additionally, UNLV Dance is producing a very unique show called That Show About the Hot Dog, and I have lots to say about this. First off, it comes to us from CFA CoLab, which UNLV describes as a performance group of actors, dancers, composers, visual artists, and designers, all hailing from the 7 units of the College of Fine Arts. CFA CoLab ideas spring from a single idea or image, and then from that, UNLV's creative Voltron creates this whole new show. Clearly here, the starting point is that icon of American cuisine and sporting events. There's nothing not ridiculous about a show centered on hot dogs, so this is clearly a comedy. The synopsis for the show says that the central character is Wee Wenny Wiener, an unlikely hot dog hero searching for the inner hot dog truth. And from there, there's a series of scenes called Dogs, and they use dance and humor, of course, but also puppets and costumes, effects, visual arts, and more. That show is about hot dogs, yes, but it's also about identity and diversity. So this is not just Americana kitsch. It's also trying to say something. And you'll have 3 chances to see this unique show November 7th through the 8th at the university's Altaham Fine Arts Complex. But this one is ticketed, so plan accordingly.
Speaking of hot dogs, the World Series just ended, and you know I am nursing big feelings about that. So, Mike, I need some laughs. Let's talk about some comedy, shall we?
Yes, and this event serves also as a way to support one of our longest-running film festivals. Boulder City's Damn Short Film Festival has compiled 10 of its best comedy shorts for a program at the Beverly Theater. This is not just a showcase of local works. These films hail from 4 different countries. And on that note, this serves as a reminder that these film festivals, they are not cheap to produce. There are tons of expenses, obvious and not so obvious. And so just relying on ticket sales from the big event is not nearly enough to keep it going. Hence these ancillary events and fundraisers. But the people at Damn Short are sweetening the deal for this program, so to speak. An hour before the screening, they'll be serving light refreshments to complement your tub of popcorn. And this is a 90-minute program. It's not unsubstantial, so you'll get plenty of bang for your buck. That's all on November 11th at the Beverly.
Mike, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul.